From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Phantom Butler. One bright summer morning, Miss Wakefield and her friend Miss Smith were walking along a road in the old residential suburb of a Warwickshire town. While passing an empty, desolate-looking house, Miss Smith remarked that it looked as if it was haunted. "You are quite right," Miss Wakefield said. "It is haunted. That is why it is unoccupied. I can't tell you now what I know about the haunting, but I will this evening." When the evening came and they were seated in Miss Wakefield's prettily furnished little drawing room, Miss Wakefield began her tale. "One evening, 9 years ago, my cousin, Jane Goodman, was sitting with her friend, Lucy Barnes, in the drawing room of No. 17 Longcroft Road, the house that you thought looked haunted. "You won't mind my leaving you for a few minutes," Jane said. "There are one or two things I must tell my daily woman before she leaves. She is staying rather late than usual this evening to oblige." When Jane returned to the drawing room, after being absent for a little longer than she had anticipated, she found Lucy looking very white and agitated. "Is anything the matter?" she asked. "Aren't you feeling well?" "I'm quite all right," Lucy replied, "just a little tired. I must be going home." Jane looked distressed. "What, so soon?" "Yes," Lucy said. "I promised Mother that I would not be late." She went. Jane did not see her again for some days. One evening, Jane was sitting alone in the dining room when she heard a curious sound. She looked around the room and saw the bright handle of the door turn rapidly round and round. She at once rose and opened the door. No one was there. That same night, she woke to hear a sound like rushing water in the room. She lit the gas, but could not find anything to account for the noise. A few days later, she heard screams from the kitchen and found Emma the cook lying on the kitchen floor. She thought at first that Emma was dead, but to her great relief, Emma had only fainted. When Emma had sufficiently recovered, she told Jane what had happened. She said that she was in the larder when she heard a tremendous noise, as if a number of trays had been thrown about. She ran into the kitchen and saw a man lying on the floor, with his arms folded across his breast. He was dressed in white. His face and eyes were those of a dead man, and he had a long beard. The sight of him gave her such a dreadful shock that she fainted. She would not remain any longer in the house, but left that very day. She was very ill afterwards, and it was many weeks before she was able to resume work. The woman whom Jane engaged in her place had not been in the house long before she declared that it was haunted. She said that things were thrown about in the kitchen by invisible hands, and that she was awakened in the night by footsteps pacing up and down the floor of her room, the door handle of which kept turning round and round. She gave notice to leave before she had been in the house a week. The day on which the new cook came, Jet met Lucy Barnes in the town, and Lucy told her what had happened the evening when she had appeared so pale and agitated. She was sitting by the window reading when she heard a cough. It sounded at her elbow. Thinking that it was Jane, she turned to speak to her. To her surprise, however, it was not Jane, but a tall figure in white, with a death-like face and a long beard. The apparition glided round the room 3 or 4 times and disappeared through the wall near the fireplace, from which there issued waves of gruesome, luminous blue vapor. She was so appalled that she felt on the verge of fainting. After hearing Lucy's account of what had happened on that particular occasion, Jane told her about the phantom that the cook had seen lying in the kitchen floor, and about the mysterious turning of the door handles and the disturbing noises. Jane decided then and there to resign her tenancy of the house, and in less than a week she left. No tenants ever remained in the house for the full duration of their lease. A butler is rumored to have committed suicide in the house, Miss Wakefield said, and it may have been his ghost that Lucy Barnes and the cook saw. I have seen the room in which he killed himself. It is in the basement. The sun's rays never penetrate into it, and the atmosphere, even in warm weather, is always chilly. On the worn stone-flagged floor, there is a broad red stain which no amount of scrubbing can ever efface. It is believed to be human blood. The butler cut his throat. Edinburgh Ghosts. Lawsuits concerning ghostly happenings are by no means uncommon. Many people interested in hauntings will doubtless recollect a case that occurred in Dublin in 1885 and another in Drogheda in 1890. In both these cases, the landlords concerned strongly objected to their houses being alleged to be haunted. In 1835, Captain Molesworth rented a house at Trinity near Edinburgh, which belonged to a Mr. Webster. After he had been in the house for about 2 months, he began to complain of extraordinary noises and accused Mr. Webster, who lived next door, of making them. Mr. Webster indignantly repudiated the charges. The noises continued, and Captain Molesworth not only took up the boards in the room in which the noises were worst, but bored holes in one of the walls which divided his residence from that of Mr. Webster in order to detect the culprit. His efforts were fruitless. The disturbances became worse. There were footsteps made by invisible feet, knocking, scratchings, and the rustling of dresses. Sometimes the knocker seemed to be trying to play a tune, and if asked a question, would respond by so many knocks. Alarming things happened. Beds were raised during the night as if someone was underneath them, and the knockings were so violent at times that the walls shook. Captain Molesworth had had two daughters, one of whom was named Matilda, the other one Jane. Matilda had died recently. Jane, who was between 12 and 13 years of age, was frequently ill in bed. The fact that the noises were generally most frequent and loudest in her room made some people think that she made them. Other people thought that it was the ghost of Matilda, warning Jane that she was doomed to die very shortly. Sheriff's officers, masons, magistrates, army officers, and friends and relatives of Captain Molesworth spent nights in the house in the hope of solving the mystery. Jane was bound in order to prevent her playing any tricks, all to no purpose. The disturbances continued and grew worse and worse. At length, unable to stand the haunting any longer, Captain Molesworth left the house. Mr. Webster brought an action against him for the damages committed by taking up the boards, breaking the walls, and firing bullets at the wainscoting, as well as for slander of title, declaring that the house was defamed through spreading the report that it was haunted. The lawsuit lasted for 2 years, and numerous witnesses were examined. I have been unable to find out how it ended. Jane Molesworth died soon after she left the house, and the people who subsequently took it never complained of any mysterious disturbances. Mr. Robert Chambers, in his Traditions of Edinburgh, mentions several cases of haunting in the Scottish capital. The house in which Major Weir and his sister lived was for many years haunted. People dreaded to walk past it after nightfall. William Patullo, an Edinburgh man of a roving disposition, who had been a soldier and a traveler, had the reputation of being afraid of no one and nothing. Upon hearing that Weir's house was to be let at a very low rental, he took it on a rather long lease. The night after he and his wife moved into the house, they were lying awake when they saw a figure like a calf come to the bed. It rested its forefeet on the footrail and stared at them. When it had contemplated them thus for a few moments, it slowly backed away from the bed and gradually vanished. They left the house the next day, and for 50 years it remained unoccupied by any living human being. Sometimes the house was seen during the night to be illuminated with a gruesome light, and sounds of dancing, howling, and spinning were heard proceeding from it. On several occasions, people saw the ghost of Weir emerge from the house, mount on a phantom black headless horse, and gallop away in a cloud of dust. Sometimes the whole of the inhabitants of the bow would be roused from sleep by the sound of a phantom coach and six dashing up the Lawn Market and down the bow. Inside the coach, their white evil faces looking out of the window were the ghosts of the sorcerer Weir and his satanic sister. There was a house in Edinburgh Lawn Market which for some extraordinary reason was shut up for many years. A grand banquet was about to take place in the house one night. The host and guests were seated at the table when something happened so dreadful that they all rose from their chairs and rushed out of the house. and none of them ever returned to it. The house was shut up, and everything, even the food on the table, was left just as it was when they fled. No one knew to whom the house belonged. No one ever inquired after it. No one living after that night ever saw the inside of it. What occurred to cause such a panic was never known. Possibly the house still remains closed, a house of fearful, unsolved mystery. Drumlanrig Castle in Dumfries, which was built by the first Duke of Queensberry, is said to have been haunted by the ghost of Lady Anne Douglas, who used to walk about the building with her head in one hand and her fan in the other. Every now and then she fanned her head vigorously. After the death of the first Duke of Queensberry, a phantom coach and six with a headless coachman used to be seen on the anniversary of his death, driving up to the castle. The ghost of the Duke, accompanied by a tall, hooded figure in black, emerged from the castle and got into the coach, which drove away at a furious rate, passing through the closed gate of the main lodge. The town mansion of the Duke in Canongate, a large, gloomy mansion, was likewise rumored to be haunted. After standing empty for many years, it was converted into a home for destitute people. No one seems to have inquired or cared whether the ghost frightened them. The strange experience of a minister. Few cities have contained more reputedly bad haunted houses than Edinburgh, and most of them would seem to have been in the vicinity of the Canongate. The following account of a haunting in that part of Edinburgh is based on a traditional story told to Sir Walter Scott by one of his friends. Late one night, about the beginning of the 18th century, a clergyman in Edinburgh was aroused from his sleep by loud knocking on the front door of his house. On rising and opening the door, he was confronted by a heavily cloaked, masked man who ordered him to get into a sedan chair. Not daring to disobey, as the man was armed, he did as he was bidden and was taken to a remote part of the town. On the way, he overheard a conversation between the men who were bearing him, which led them to believe that they were not ordinary sedan men, but belonged to a very superior class. When at last they set him down, they blindfolded him, threatening to kill him if he resisted or uttered a sound. They then led him into a building, across what appeared to be a very spacious hall, up a flight of stairs, along a corridor to a large, well-furnished room. There they removed the bandage from his eyes. They then conducted him into an inner chamber in which a lady, who had recently been delivered of a child, was lying in bed. He was ordered by one of the men who had brought him to the house to say such prayers by the bedside as were appropriate for a person not expected to survive for many hours. He remonstrated, expressing his opinion that the lady did not appear to be in such a critical condition. He was sternly commanded to obey his instructions and threatened with severe punishment if he hesitated and dallied. In fear and trembling, he knelt by the bedside, and as soon as he had finished praying, he was again blindfolded. As he was being hurriedly led downstairs, he heard the significant report of a firearm. He was taken safely home and given a large sum of money, but at the same time warned that the least allusion to what had transpired that night would cost him his life. Early in the morning, his servant came to his room in a great state of excitement and informed him that a house in close proximity to the Canongate had been destroyed by fire during the night, and that the owner's daughter, a lady eminent for her beauty and accomplishments, had perished in the flames. The clergyman had his suspicions. The family, whom he suspected of being responsible for the tragedy, was wealthy and influential. He was poor, without influence, and naturally timid. To have made public his suspicions would have availed nothing. It would only have antagonized the family and jeopardized his safety. So he held his tongue. The deed was done, he reflected, and could not be undone. As the years went by, he grew less apprehensive and cautious, and finally relayed his experience on the night of the fire to some of his fellow clergy. He died shortly afterwards. His tale, which had been widely circulated, was after a time nearly forgotten, when something happened which recalled it vividly to mind. A fire broke out on the very same site on which the house that figured so tragically in the clergyman's story had once stood. When the fire was at its height, the phantom of a lovely woman in a costly but very antique style of nightdress appeared in the midst of the raging flames, and in an awful voice cried out, "Once burn, twice burn, the third time I will scare you all." She then vanished, The people who had assembled to view the conflagration saw and heard the apparition and were so terrified that they lost no time in quitting the scene. The belief in this traditional story was formerly so strong in Edinburgh that on a fire occurring for the third time on the same site, there was considerable apprehension lest the phantom should fulfill her threat. Apparently she relented, for nothing very dreadful happened. For several years after the third fire, a red stain was to be seen on the wall of the house which had suffered in the conflagration. It was probably paint. The superstitious people, remembering the clergyman's story, believed it to have been put there by the phantom of the beautiful lady as a reminder of the awful manner of her death. At Holyrood, the stains of Rizzio's blood are still shown on the floor of the passage near the back stairs leading from Queen Mary's room. According to tradition, they are indelible, and no amount of scrubbing can efface them. One wonders if a serious attempt has ever been made. In the second series of the Chronicles of the Canongate, reference is made to them in the introduction, where the Cockney attempt to remove them by scouring drops, much to the horror of the housekeeper, and can only be induced to desist by the entreaties of Mr. Crystal Coughedangry, who explained that they ought to remain indelible on account of the association with which they were connected. Robert Chambers regards them in the light of a traditionary absurdity. Since the boards are comparatively modern, it must have been laid down long after the murder of Rizzio, the old floor of this day being no doubt worn out. A Haunted Inn. Traditional stories of hauntings in connection with the days of wreckers and smugglers do not appear to be so numerous in Scotland as they are in England. Hugh Miller, in his Scenes and Legends of the North of Scotland, relates a case of haunting arising out of the accidental killing of a notorious Scottish smuggler. In the reign of Queen Anne, John MacLeod, a merchant of Cromarty, owned the principal inn in that town. He had an only son, Walter, who for several years had been very actively engaged in smuggling in brazen defiance of the officers of the revenue. He was in the habit of transferring the goods which he had smuggled from a cavern on the seashore to a vault in his father's inn. One evening, soon after he had brought home a fresh supply of smuggled goods, mostly spirits, he was sitting by the kitchen fire, talking to his father, when two revenue officers entered the inn and asked for liquor. Walter, as soon as he saw them, edged away from under the lamp which lighted the kitchen and muffled himself up in the folds of his dreadnought greatcoat. His father attended to the officers. One of the officers inquired for Walter and expressed a hope that he was not on board a smuggler's vessel that had been captured in Scottish waters that morning, as it would go hard with the prisoners since they had fired on a revenue ship. Another officer requested the landlord to give him the key of the cellar, and on MacLeod demurring and asking if he had a search warrant, he told him that he had been informed his son had brought 3 cartloads of Geneva to the inn that day and had stowed them away on the premises. Warrant or no warrant, he intended to search the premises. He was about to carry out his threat when Walter MacLeod emerged from his corner and, standing between him and the cellar door, swore he would shoot the first man who attempted to pass him. 2 of the officers threw themselves on Walter, and a desperate struggle ensued. Walter knocked one of his assailants down and was overcoming the other when his father, mistaking him for the officer, struck him on the head with a kitchen poker. He fell on the floor and died very shortly after. John MacLeod did not long survive him. His anguish of mind terminated in insanity, and he died within a few weeks of his son's tragic ending. After his death, the inn, which remained unoccupied for several years, speedily acquired a reputation for being haunted. David Hood, a Cromarty tailor, was passing by it one night when he heard sounds of a desperate struggle going on inside it, the dashing of furniture against the wall, the blows of the combatants, a dull thud as of a heavy body falling onto a wooden floor, a fearful shriek and a sorrowful voice exclaiming, "I have murdered my son! I have murdered my son!" David Hood was appalled and never ventured near the inn again after nightfall. The first occupants of the inn after John MacLeod's death were frequently awakened at night by crashes and bangs, as if a fearful fight was taking place in the kitchen. Yet in the morning no furniture was ever found displaced. Worse things happened. Some of the inmates, as they lay in bed trying to sleep, in spite of the ghostly sounds, were scared almost out of their senses by seeing their doors slowly open and pale, menacing faces peering in at them. On one occasion, one of the children, a boy, was looking at some old magazines in one of the garrets when he felt someone was near him. He looked up and saw a very tall, broad-shouldered man with a pale, ghastly countenance standing by the door. He was wearing a brown, red-knot overcoat, a good deal astonished but not at all frightened, for he did not realize that the figure he saw was a ghost. The little boy ran downstairs and told his sister that there was a muckle big man at the top of the house. His sister at once summoned some of the neighbors who searched the house from the garrets to the cellars without discovering a trace of the mysterious stranger. These were only a few of the ghostly occurrences that acquired for the inn the unpleasant reputation of being very badly haunted. Two haunted houses. In the early years of the 19th century, there was living in one wing of an old mansion house of Garleton in the Scottish Highlands, Miss Janet Hepburn, sister of Colonel Hepburn of Luffness and Congalton. She was elderly, tall and thin, and when walking in the grounds of the house, always wore a black silk cloak and bonnet, and carried a large cane ornamented with a gold chain and tassel. She often rambled out of doors in the dead of night and early morning, until her clothes were saturated with rain or dew, when she hurried back to the house, tore them off, and scrambled into bed, to stay there till noon or even later. Mainly on account of her extreme eccentricity, she was regarded with terror and aversion by the neighboring superstitious villagers. Having sauntered out one evening, before sunrise, she sat down to rest a while on a craggy hill. She had not been there long when a very odd-looking man, in somber black clothes, who seemed to rise from the ground, slowly approached her. He was very pale, unkempt, and emaciated, and his eyes had such a strange expression in them that she was scared, and shook her cane at him to keep him off. He went away muttering, and disappeared in the same sudden and mysterious manner as he had appeared. Try how she would, she could not banish him from her mind. The thought of him frightened her so much that she exercised more than usual care that night before going to bed. She made sure all the windows and doors were shut and securely fastened, and after locking the outer door, she put the key of it under her pillow. She did not venture out of doors, but sat up till a late hour reading. When she was in bed, she could not sleep. She could not expel the peculiar man she had seen in the grounds that morning from her thoughts. She was lying awake, trying all kinds of devices to send her to sleep, when she heard the front door, which she had so carefully locked and bolted, open. A few moments later, she heard heavy steps cross the hall and ascend the stairs leading to her room. Presently, the door slowly opened. Sick with terror, she forced herself to sit up and ask in a trembling voice who was there, although she knew instinctively that it must be the man who had terrified her. She was not mistaken. It was the man. "This is my native place," he said. "I have a long history which I must tell you." He moved slowly toward the bed. Thinking he had come to rob and perhaps kill her, she pointed to a box containing her money and jewelry and bade him take what he wanted and be gone. He tried to speak, to tell her the reason of his visit, but she would not listen. She crossed herself. She was a Roman Catholic, put her fingers in her ears, and once again told him to go. For a second or two, he stood irresolute, and then, eyeing her angrily, he turned and left the room. She heard him tramping down the creaking stairs and across the hall. The front door opened and closed with a bang, and then there was a deep, unbroken silence. Only two other people, an aged spinster and her servant, besides herself and her maid, were in the building, and they were in the other wing of it. In the morning, when the maid brought her her tea, she told her what had happened and asked her to search to see if anything had been disturbed. The maid, who said she had heard a strange voice in the night, looked everywhere. The chest where the family plate was kept had not been opened. The doors and windows were all fastened, just as they had been when Miss Hepburn went to bed. Nothing was disturbed, and there was no sign of anyone having entered the house. Miss Hepburn was thoroughly convinced now that her visitor in the night came from another world. Exactly 12 months later, Miss Hepburn died suddenly, about the hour when she had seen, for the second time, the phantom man in black with the terrifying eyes. Mr. Horace Welby, author of Signs Before Death, was told this story by an intimate acquaintance of Miss Hepburn, who vouched for the truth of it. When I was staying in Forfarshire, I used to go frequently to Montrose. A lady who lived in John Street told me that her aunt lived in a haunted house not far from Montrose. She said there was a room in the house, the door of which would never keep shut during the night unless something very heavy was placed against it. The lock had frequently been examined and found to be in perfectly good order, yet if the door was locked, it invariably flew open, and always between 2 and 3 o'clock. Bells sometimes rang without any apparent cause. My informant and her aunt were sitting in the parlor one afternoon when they heard footsteps cross the floor. They looked to see who it was, but no one was there in the room except themselves. Their attention was drawn to the wall by the fireplace, and they both saw the handle of the old-fashioned wire bell pulled violently out. On several occasions, all the bells in the house suddenly rang and heavy footsteps were heard running up the stairs. Nothing ghostly was ever seen but often felt, especially on the staircase and in the parlor. My informant was frightened only once in the house, and that was when she was going upstairs one morning, and there was a loud crash on the stairs just behind her. She was considerably startled and was unable to discover anything to account for the sound. No tragedy was known to have ever occurred in the house, but it was believed to have been built on the site of an old cemetery, which might possibly afford an explanation for the hauntings. The Haunted Corridor. Considerable interest was exhibited towards the end of the last century in widespread rumors of the haunting of B House near F, in the southwest of England. The hearing of these rumors led Mr. W. and his friend Mr. K. to ask permission of the D family who owned the house to spend the night in it, in order to find out if there was any truth in the alleged haunting. Permission having been obtained, Mr. W. and his friend went to the house during the absence of the owners. They dined early, and soon after the meal took up their positions in the corridor, where they understood that most of the ghostly happenings occurred. The corridor was very long, with a door at each end of it. They set a table across the corridor so as to bar the progress of any earthly intruder, and on it laid the revolvers which they had brought with them in case of hoaxers. They placed 2 tall lighted candles on the floor near the wall, and about 3 feet from the table, they sat on the table and played piquet and écarté until the big clock in the hall sounded midnight. They then ceased playing and listened very intently. They heard nothing. Mr. K. yawned. "I say, it's nonsense staying here any longer," he exclaimed. "No ghost ever comes after 12 o'clock. Supposing we have just one more game and then go to bed." Mr. W. looked at his watch, which he had taken the precaution to set by the church clock, and found that the house clock was fast. By the right time, it was not 12. He proposed that they should remain in the corridor for at least 1/4 hour longer. The words were hardly out of his mouth when they were acutely aware that something had entered the corridor. The silence was soon broken by the clicking of high-heeled shoes on the polished boards of the corridor. As the footsteps drew nearer, they could hear rustling and what sounded like the brushing of a stiff silk dress against the walls, but they could see nothing. They were petrified with amazement and not a little scared. The footsteps passed the candles, the table, and the 2 men, and continued to the end of the corridor. There was a sound of a door shutting very violently, and after that there was silence. Mr. W. and his friend retired very hurriedly to bed, convinced that B House was really very nastily haunted. On one occasion, a nurse had to pass through the corridor, leading a little girl who was deaf and dumb. As the ghostly sounds approached and passed them, the child exhibited the utmost fright, clinging to the nurse and burying her face in the nurse's dress, as if to exclude the vision of something very awful. She could never be induced to enter the corridor again. The Leering Death's Head. During the 80s and early 90s of the last century, a large building near Aldershot was haunted by a ghost in armor, a phantom lady in white, and an invisible, terrifying ghost. The white lady always predicted the death of someone closely connected with the building. She was seen on 3 occasions by 3 different people immediately prior to the death of a well-known bishop. A lady who visited the building in 1893 was sitting by her bedroom fire one night when there was a loud knock on the door. She called out, "Come in." The knock was repeated. Again she bade the person to enter. There was another knock. The handle of the door turned noisily. The door flew open, admitting a current of icy air. The floor shook violently, as if some very heavy weight had been dropped or hurled onto it. The lady sensed the presence in the room of something very horrible and intensely malevolent. She was so frightened that she jumped into bed and hid under the clothes. She lay there quaking, too scared to move or utter a sound until the morning. She left the building soon after she had her breakfast, declaring that nothing would induce her to stay another night there. The ghost in armor used to steal quietly into rooms, pinch the toes of sleepers to rouse them, raise its visor and disclose to their horrified gaze the ghastly leering face of a skeleton. Fortunately for the occupants of the building, the haunting by this phantom was very infrequent. The cause and origin of the hauntings, if known, was never divulged to the public. The Evil Countess. In the early 60s of the last century, Mr. Robinson, a man who had acquired considerable wealth and trade, bought an old house near Walton-on-Thames that had for many years belonged to a well-known aristocratic family. As the house lacked modern convenience and was not large enough for his family, Mr. Robinson had most of it pulled down and erected a fine, imposing mansion in its place. It was not until the Robinsons had been in the house for some weeks and a visitor came to stay with them that the disturbances began. The visitor was awakened one night by the sound of footsteps in the corridor outside a room. They sounded as if someone wearing high-heeled shoes was tapping their way very cautiously along the corridor. They stopped outside the visitor's room. The visitor heard the door handle turn and called out, "Who is there? What do you want?" There was no reply, and the door slowly opened. The visitor became alarmed. She sat up in bed and saw an old woman, clad in costly garments belonging to a bygone period. Jewels sparkled on her waist and arms. She had white hair and black eyes, which gleamed evilly as they encountered the gaze of the terrified visitor. A gruesome light seemed to surround her. She crossed the floor to the fireplace, raised a skinny hand and shook it menacingly at the visitor, and vanished. The visitor left the house the following day. After she had gone, strange and startling sounds were heard in the house during the night. There were crashes, as if all the crockery in the kitchen had been thrown onto the tiled floor, trampings up and down the staircases, and mocking laughter. People who slept in the room that had been occupied by the visitor were visited in the night by the phantom of the old woman with the evil eyes. She pulled the clothes off the bed, and if there was a candle or nightlight, blew it out. The room had finally to be used for lumber only and kept locked. The noises continued and became so violent that the Robinsons were compelled to sell the house. The haunting then ceased. The ghost was believed to be that of a certain wicked countess, an ancestress of the family who had sold the property to the Robinsons. She had been greatly attached to the house and always declared that she would haunt anyone who destroyed or altered any part of it. Another haunting of an equally alarming description also occurred in the 60s of the last century. The Reverend Ernst Edwards accepted a curacy in a town in Rutlandshire. He took a small house on a 4 years lease and moved into it with his wife and family. Nothing unusual happened until one Sunday evening when Mrs. Edwards and the cook were alone in the house. About 7 o'clock, Mrs. Edwards heard a great noise in the room directly under the one in which she was sitting. A door slammed, a window was thrown up, curtains were pulled noisily, and furniture was banged about and dragged across the floor. Mrs. Edwards rang for the cook and inquired angrily what was going on in the room beneath her. The cook said that no one was in the house but herself, and that she had not heard any noise. Not satisfied, Mrs. Edwards, accompanied by the cook, went down to the room. Nothing had been disturbed. She wondered if she had imagined the sounds. A few nights later, she again heard them, and the same thing happened. When she went to the room, the sounds ceased, and nothing had been moved. After that, night strange, unaccountable noises were heard in all parts of the house. Two of the maids were sitting in a room on the ground floor, one fine, perfectly still evening, when they heard the curtain in the front of the window rustle and saw it swell out as if someone was concealed behind it. There was a distinct impress of a tall body. Directly they screamed, the swelling went down and the curtain hung quite naturally.
The cook, who heard the screams, ran to the room, and the three women looked apprehensively behind the curtain. The window was shut and fastened. There was nothing to explain the rustling and swelling of the curtain. The next day, the maids gave notice to leave. The new maids did not stay long, and the Edwardses, worried by the ghostly happenings, left the house long before the termination of their lease. Their inquiries as to the cause of the haunting proved fruitless. Ghosts apparently take a peculiar pleasure in harassing and tormenting clergymen and their families.